survival. For Americans who've suffered trauma, what does it mean to survive?
People want you to get over it. You know, I wasn't shot. I'm not in a wheelchair or anything like that. You know, people say just, you know, move along.
I used to say that I'd been drafted, and I didn't even know that there was a war.
On this Memorial Day, coping after trauma, I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Also this hour, a look at PTSD and how far the research has come and the non-traditional treatments that some vets are now trying.
I confronted the root of my problems with combat, which was really forgiveness. I had thought I was, you know, a monster.
And a new album that explores the issues service members face when they return to civilian life.
Part of telling the story is being uncomfortably vulnerable.
This is The Takeaway.
Surviving to me means finding hope every day.
I try not to think about the future too much because it gives me anxiety.
What am I actually going through?
It is the dark moments at night. The nightmares and flashbacks don't ever seem to cease.
Just getting through each day, you know, is really important. That's how I've been surviving.
Surviving to me is do what I can do.
Finding hope that one day you sleep well.
You can see it, it's fuzzy, you don't know what it looks like, it's out there, but go towards it. It still gets me through every day.
Surviving.
Surviving.
Surviving is finding that little piece of hope every single day. And that little piece of hope becomes stronger.
Surviving. On this Memorial Day, conversations about what it means to survive and cope with trauma. I'm Tanzina Vega, and thank you so much for joining us. And to all the vets and families with loved ones who served in our nation's wars, we wish you and everyone a very happy Memorial Day. Whether coming home from war or being the victim of a traumatic event like a mass shooting, millions of Americans are surviving trauma every day. We start the show by replaying a segment that we first aired a couple of months ago, 19 years after the massacre at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. For people who survive mass shootings, they then have to consider what comes next. The three voices you just heard have faced that very question. Jacob Garrett and Tim McGrath both survived the movie theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado in 2012, and Kim Woodruff survived the shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Their stories are featured in a new film written and directed by Tim McGrath. It's called Surviving Theater 9. The three of them sat down together in our studios, and Tim leads them in conversation.
I was at law school and having panic attacks every few days. And when you're in a law school classroom and everyone's very smart and erudite, you kind of want to not be sweating profusely. So I'd run out and try and calm myself down. And I couldn't find the proper therapy. I was on campus and the therapists there were trying very hard, but it just wasn't working. And then I called the Aurora Center, and the woman there, Grace, put me in touch with Kim. And so Kim had been through Columbine and was giving Tai Chi classes for free just to help the other survivors. So how did you decide to do that?
I was part of the Rebels Project. And what we tried to do is we tried to bring the Aurora community together with the Columbine community. And the thing I noticed in our first meeting was, wow, there's a lot of Columbine kids that are still day one. And I had found my peace. And so I was like, I want to help people. How do I do that? What did I do differently? And what I discovered was I actively chose to fight for my peace. And the structure I used was Tai Chi because it allowed me to process how I needed to, instead of it being a therapist telling me how I needed to process my world, I would bring up my own memories when I needed to process them. I would go through each PTSD episode, each PTSD trigger, and analyze it and figure out what was the root. Next time I experienced that trigger, what was the one thing I was going to do different? And I actually thought I was one of the last people to find their peace after Columbine. But when the Aurora Theater shooting happened and the communities came together, I realized I was actually one of the few that actually made it out to find their peace.
Jacob, maybe if you could talk about like what you do with your music.
Well, I've always been super into music, but after the theater happened and everything, I just found it to be like really therapeutic. Just like it would get my mind off of anything that I was worried about or anxious about. If I just sat down at my piano and played a couple songs, and I would just forget about everything or write everything that I was thinking. I would write it down and try and make it into a song. That's always really helped for me, just to not feel anxious and get my bad feelings, my bad thoughts out, so I don't have to constantly live with them.
How did you decide to participate in the film?
I've always wanted to help people. Like, I always try and be a really nice person. I just thought that it would be really cool for people to hear my story and see that, you know, I'm alive. I'm still living my life, you know, just day by day. And, you know, I feel like it would give people strength. Like, yeah, he has a really hard time making it through the day, but he makes it. So, you know, I should be able to make it through the day too.
I think when you were 13, when I did that first interview, it was you had a quote in there. You said something about, because sometimes people go through a lot. I remember that rang. It still rings in my head. And you had this sort of world weariness as a soldier come back from war. Actually, would you speak to that? Because you say that about you were a soldier you went to war, but you weren't trained.
Yeah. I used to say that I'd been drafted, and I didn't even know that there was a war. That's how it felt in that moment on that day. I suddenly found myself in a war zone, and I had no training, nothing to help. And to come back from that was a really hard experience, because mass shootings like that hadn't happened to that degree. So nobody really knew how to help people with it. I mean, obviously, there's been plenty of soldiers coming back from our various wars, and I ended up having many of them come to my Tai Chi class after I started teaching, and they seemed to appreciate it. We were able to connect as to what it meant to have to go through a PTSD episode and how you deal with that survivor's guilt.
Jacob, what for you are kind of the ongoing things from whatever it's been now, 5 or 6 years?
I could not finish high school because I would get so anxious in school, being in a classroom with all those people. And I had to drop out and get my GED because I just had so much anxiety. I'm doing a lot better now that I'm not in school. I don't have to be in a classroom every day. And
was it the constraint of being in a classroom? That's when I was at law school, that's what it felt.
Yeah.
You got to get out, right?
Yeah. I had my mom come and pick me up so many times from school because I just couldn't handle it. I couldn't finish the day.
That was one of the triggers that was really hard for me. I ended up becoming a school teacher and having to go back into that space where you have one way in, one way out. It took a while. I worked with a process called Small Victories, where you have to see your process as the victories instead of seeing it as, oh my goodness, this is a horrible day. This is, you know, I'm not getting through it. You have to stop and think, wait, I did something right today. I got out of bed first off. Not only that, I brushed my teeth so my breath doesn't smell bad, right? I found that creating those small victories really helped. Especially like when I would have PTSD episodes. When I was going through my teacher training, I knew that the building we were going to that day, they were going to do a fire drill. And it was the first time since graduating Columbine that I'd had to experience a fire drill. I had this full-blown PTSD episode, tears streaming down my face, frozen, shaking, you know, the whole bit. And my teacher came and she was like, what is going on? And I was like, I have PTSD. I can't do this today. I gotta go. And so I went back to my car and, you know, cried for a good 20 minutes. Then I had to stop and I was like, okay, if I'm living a life of small victories, even in this moment where I think I have been completely defeated, I have to find how did I win? And I found 4 victories. 1, I went to a building knowing that there was going to be a fire alarm that day. I actively told somebody when I couldn't handle it. I got myself out of the situation when I needed to. And 4, I had the ability to tell somebody that that's what it was. After having those 4 victories, I was that much stronger for the next time. I was able to sit through the fire drill the next time in complete panic mode, but I sat through it.
It's something that, yeah, it's not fun to talk about as I'm stunted here. And it's not something that you want to go out and share. And I think, you know, it's something that comes in that's very shocking, like a cancer diagnosis out of the blue or something. And then it's internationally known and everyone has their ideas of, you know, what it's like and what it might not be like. And it brings up fears in other people because by the nature of it, it's random. People want you to get over it. You know, I wasn't shot. I'm not in a wheelchair or anything like that. And so,
neither was I.
Yeah. So it's, you know, people say just, you know, move along. You kind of have to be brave with it with yourself. And you kind of don't want to involve someone else in that who's not going to be brave because they're just, you know, have their own ideas of what it is.
I've always thought that I've had to keep my anxiety and my like episodes and all my problems to myself because no one else would really understand. Because I don't really fully understand it myself. I still don't know all my triggers. Like, I could get triggered by something totally random that I wouldn't have ever thought that could be a trigger, but I'll start having an episode and I don't even know how to get past it. So I wouldn't want to put that burden on anybody else.
Getting to the point where I could verbalize what I was going through was actually really helpful for me. I had to start identifying myself by what I was experiencing and know that I had to be stronger than that. If I was going to get over it, I had to find a way. So I turned the survivor's guilt on its head. I took that continuously questioning mind that's always like, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And I turned it to be, why is this trigger this way? And it took me a long time to write down all of my triggers. I worked through them one by one until I only have 2 left. And my message to survivors is find the hope within yourself. We're all on this healing journey, and we all take different paths in that journey. But find a way to make life worth living.
Yeah. First and foremost, you're not alone. It feels very isolating. I don't know if that's because of the extreme circumstances of it. I don't know if it's because of the random nature of it. But there are a lot of other people that get you. And, you can get through and you can do productive things and complex things and live an exciting life again.
My message to survivors would be, you're alive. You know, like we're all alive still. We're here. And just trying to get through the day can be hard, especially if you're having a really bad day and there's just lots of bad things going on that you can't handle. But you can get through it because you're still here and it's gonna be worth it.
Survivors Jacob Garrett, Kim Woodruff, and Tim McGrath. For more information about the movie Surviving Theater 9, written and directed by Tim McGrath, go to our website, thetakeaway.org. We just heard from a roundtable of gun survivors about the trauma they've experienced and how they're coping. For the thousands of veterans coming home from war, this is something many are living with every day. Post-traumatic stress disorder is often thought of as the invisible wound of war, and over the last 15 years, hundreds of thousands of veterans have been diagnosed with the disorder. But until recently, PTSD was thought of primarily as an emotional injury, not a physical one. So what does PTSD actually do to a person's brain? Here to help us understand is Dr. Charles Marmer, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at New York University, where he directs the PTSD and TBI program. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So what do we know about what PTSD does to a person's brain at the physical level?
There are an enormous number of complex changes in the brain that affects multiple different interrelated systems that result in the end picture of persistent reliving, remembering, sleep disruption, avoidance of reminders, and chronic anxious arousal. All those are driven in part by profound brain chemistry changes and further changes in specific brain circuits, which we summarized in a recent New England Journal of Medicine article, in circuits affecting memory, learning, and in particular, the ability to separate a dangerous context from a safe one. One of my traumatized returning Iraq War veterans was out on a perfectly pleasant Saturday afternoon driving down Madison Avenue in New York and told me by the time he got to his destination, he was exhausted. And I said, what made it so difficult? He said, well, doctor, you must understand, I have to monitor every garbage can on every corner of Madison Avenue to be certain there are no explosive devices.
That's very stressful, it sounds like, just emotionally taxing, right?
Yes, and deploys your attention away from other things, such as driving safely, perhaps, or even just enjoying the beauty of a pleasant day with a friend.
Talk to me a little bit about the advances that have been made in PTSD research, particularly over the past decade. What's different 10 years ago than what we know today?
A number of things. First, we understand much more about the underlying molecular and brain circuit changes that are present in post-traumatic stress disorder. Second, we have a better idea about how to safely treat post-traumatic stress disorder using a combination of psychotherapeutic approaches, medications judiciously as needed, and many other adjunctive treatments, group, yoga, meditation, art therapy, even some experimental new brain treatments such as transcranial magnetic stimulation. So the field has rapidly matured. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a common and disabling disorder, not just among warfighters. 85% of all PTSD cases in America are civilian cases related to motor vehicle accidents, domestic violence, disaster, and other stressful life events. And so we've learned an enormous amount how to treat this disorder in both civilians and in veterans. That being said, a huge amount more of research needs to be done. The number of clinical trials of novel treatments is relatively limited compared to, say, the study of depression. So much work needs to be done. With the new knowledge we have from neuroscience particularly, we're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years several dramatic changes. One, we're going to be able to more objectively diagnose post-traumatic stress disorder using such things as brain imaging patterns, blood chemistry, and even quality of the human voice. Second, we're going to be able to understand which treatment is best for which person. One of the radical changes taking place in the field of PTSD and all of neuropsychiatry is we're moving away from a one-size-fits-all treatment to personalized medicine. By analogy, what's done in cancer, if someone is struggling with breast cancer or prostate cancer, they get different treatments based on the genetic picture of that cancer. We are in the process of developing neuroimaging tests and blood chemistry tests and other approaches that will tell us which treatment for which person at which time.
What you mentioned earlier, that it's not just veterans that deal with PTSD. In fact, you said 85% of the country that's dealing with PTSD affected are not veterans. So what are the sort of differences, or are there differences between what a veteran suffers, the type of PTSD, compared to living through gun violence, for example, or domestic abuse? Are the symptoms essentially the same?
They're very similar. They're more similar than different. The biology may be somewhat different, but the fundamental features, which are disturbing thoughts, images during the daytime, disturbing dreams, difficulty falling asleep and staying asleep, the reluctance to discuss the events, whether domestic violence or war, with other people because it brings back painful memories, and the change in how we think about ourselves and the world. Before being traumatized, people tend to see the world as a safe, controllable, and predictable place. After being badly traumatized, people see the world often as a dangerous, uncontrollable, and unpredictable place. And finally, there are symptoms of chronic anxious arousal, such as being jumpy, easily startled, and being on guard and vigilant even in a safe environment. Those are common across all forms of PTSD.
Dr. Charles Marmar is chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at New York University. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us.
It was really a pleasure.
Outside of more mainstream therapies for PTSD, there's a class of drugs that's currently being tested, psychedelics. And one of those psychedelics is known as MDMA. Tom Schroeder is a journalist and author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. And he explains just how these treatments work.
When we think about most drugs, we think of the drug sort of acting directly on something in your body. Penicillin kills the infection, for instance. Well, MDMA doesn't work like that. What it does is it puts the person in a state where they are able to go back and examine the trauma that created the PTSD in the first place. It also sort of liberates you from going over the same reaction that you always have when a negative idea comes up. People are reactive to it. But MDMA sort of enables the brain to find new ways of looking at it. The experience of that is suddenly you're flooded with insights. You know, like I remember there was a case of a woman who had been sexually abused in her youth by her mother's lovers, and she had terrible PTSD. And while she was going through the therapy and under the influence of the MDMA, she was able to recall this. And the insight she had was, my mother traded my childhood for sex. And that was not an easy thing to realize, but it was necessary for her to sort of untangle the psychic knots that she'd been tied in for two decades.
And is this because it lowers your guard? Is that because it makes the person feel more vulnerable?
Actually, a lot of people say what happens when they take MDMA is they feel a sense of being protected. And it allows them to look at things with a sense of detachment and to really understand them for the first time. So when you're looking at a negative thing, you're not sort of clutching your entire body in fear. Instead, you're looking at it with a certain dispassionate attachment. You know, somebody who had been severely traumatized when they were on the MDMA, you know, you begin to visualize things. And they said, I feel like I'm floating above the battlefield. And I see that the only way out of this is I have to somehow get out of this battlefield. And even though it didn't immediately solve the problem, he says, what I can see is that there are paths out of it. And what I need to do is start following one of those paths.
I do want to ask you, though, because there can be, with any drug, there is the potential for a negative experience, particularly with psychotropics. I think people would say, well, you know, you could have a quote-unquote bad trip. What is the risk for patients who choose to try this as an alternative?
That's why it's so important to do these things under carefully arranged circumstances with professional guidance, because MDMA can have a bad anxiety reaction, which can feel like a bad trip. But what's really happening in therapy, what happens when people get anxious and when they start to have these bad reactions, is actually that's the trauma or something that they need to deal with that's starting to emerge. And the therapists are trained, and the thing that they're looking for is to help people sort of use these moments, of these difficult moments, to realize that they're getting close to something important. And very often, that's exactly what leads to a big breakthrough. So the safety record in these trials has been extremely good. They haven't had any really serious psychiatric problems result from this. And that's because that they're trained to deal with these difficult moments, and that the difficult moments are actually opportunities for resolving problems.
Tom Schroeder is a journalist and author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
One of the very first things that I had was the problem with anxiety, these waves of anxiety, like I think a panic attack was coming on. Once the drug would start kicking in, I would have these visuals. And the first thing I heard was like this higher voice. It was me, but it just said, breathe. And whenever I breathed, it was just like really from the belly. And when I took that deep breath, I noticed the anxiety went away. I was like, oh, that's cool. And then all of a sudden another wave of anxiety came, and I tried the breath and it went away. So it was like these less and less waves, like when you're wading out into the ocean and you have to go through those waves and then you finally get to this stillness. In that experience, I confronted the root of my problems with combat, which was really forgiveness. My name is Nicholas Blackston. I'm 32 and a former combat Marine veteran.
Nicholas Blackston did two deployments to Iraq between 2004 and 2008. And during that time, his truck was hit with an RPG, he suffered serious injuries, and his friend and comrade lost his life. When Nicholas began to transition back to civilian life, he had difficulty coping. He was anxious, stressed, detached, and had suicidal thoughts. And he became one of the first veterans to get the experimental MDMA treatment for his severe PTSD. And what we just heard was his experience going through that treatment. Before MDMA, Nicholas said he'd tried all the treatments available, and none of them seemed to work. In fact, he was considered what's called treatment resistant. And then he started looking at non-traditional options.
I was going through school at the time, and the only thing that had helped was smoking marijuana. That allowed me, as I'd say, just stop the gunfire. I would always just, the stuff in my head was so distracting, and it actually helped me focus on school and get my work done, but it was just minimal, maybe for an hour, and panic attacks and symptoms would kind of come back. But I was searching the internet for all kinds of alternative healing. While I was on the internet, I found someone who was from the first phase study, and they were on, it's like on CNN. It was just basically the tag MDMA for PTSD. And so I started looking into it, and I was still a little iffy because that's chemically concocted. It was like a pill, and it didn't feel like natural. But I was suffering from, suicide, to be honest with you. I was hopeless, and I didn't feel like there was anything that could help. And so I had stepped away from a moment of suicide, and I smoked. And I had a moment of clarity, and that's when I was searching on the internet, and I came across that. So I kind of took it as a sign, and I followed it. And so I got onto Maps, and I found out that they just happened to be doing a study that they were starting and looking for participants, and it was right there in Charleston. So that was in 2009. In the summertime, I signed up for it. And I just kept on calling and leaving messages. And it wasn't until around November, because there's a lot of people trying to get in, apparently. And so that was in that November. And I was at the end of my rope. And I tied a knot to hang on. But if it wasn't this, you know, I felt like nothing was going to help. So I was at the very end. And what made me really want to do it was I really didn't like how I was acting towards my friends and family members. Excuse me.
It's okay.
And so I wanted that that person back. And I kind of felt like he was left over there. And fortunately, this medicine helped me, I guess, go back over there and bring that part of me back that I needed. So that it was really how I was acting towards others that made me want to get help. I didn't like being disconnected and numb to the world. So that's how I got in.
When Nicholas got back to the United States and began transitioning to civilian life, he was also suffering through severe PTSD. No therapy worked until he tried MDMA, a psychedelic medication. We heard his experience taking MDMA before the break. And we pick up now with Nicholas's experience in Iraq, an experience he says he wasn't able to fully process until his first treatment with MDMA.
It was my very first dose, actually. I confronted the root of my problems with combat, which was really forgiveness. I had pushed that part of myself down because one of the things I felt, you know, responsible for the lives that I took, I thought I was, a monster. And also, I wasn't really prepared. I thought, even though I knew casualties of war were there, I thought I was going to be fighting more like insurgents and not kids shooting at you with guns because they were paid by insurgents. And that really was a hard part. And the other thing was that I was a machine gunner, and that moment that I got blown up, I felt like it was my responsibility to have seen that coming, since all the times before I had and prevented it. But that time when we got blown up, we were all laughing because I was telling jokes, and then all of a sudden my truck's hit and I'm in another world, and it's big black void, and then I come to and the whole vehicle's on fire, and my mind's going at the speed of light, but everything's going in slow motion, and I couldn't hear anything. And then as my sound started coming back, and everyone sounded like squeaky mouses, like Mickey Mouse talking, and my ears were evidently blown out, and everything started moving fast again, and there was just this part of me, like I was watching everything like a movie.
Your recollection of this is so vivid. I feel like as you're telling me the story, I feel like I can almost see what you're describing. Did the clarity of these memories have any impact on the MDMA treatment at all? Like, what do you think made the MDMA treatment work?
Well, for me, that was what was really unique. It wasn't just, I mean, in that first session, I went back, you know, to that combat scene and relived it. And all the times before this therapy, I was going through that like five times a day. My mind was like, kept trying to take me back there, and I didn't want to. And so it was finally being able to like process this moment, you know, years later. And it seemed that it brought back everything. I could feel, I could taste sand in my mouth. I could hear the sounds. It's like you're there. But I was conscious and very aware that I'm laying on a bed. But it was just bringing that, you know, that memory back. And the greatest thing about it was that there was no fear. Like it helped me not be afraid to touch this wound. And it brings it all back to where you can finally process it. And what I found unique, which was afterwards, is that I didn't even know it until like I was done with the whole research study, and I had to take a little test, and it asked me, how often do you think about one of the moments that traumatized you? And I was like, oh my gosh, I have not thought about it.
How are you feeling today?
I finished in 2011, and each year, I mean, it obviously doesn't just instantly heals you. It's a light that comes on and gives you hope. And I was no longer suicidal. I wanted to live. It restored my emotions. One of the things is I didn't want to bring a child into the world. One of my PTSD was bad, and I felt comfortable enough. I have a 3-year-old now.
And, oh, congratulations, Nicholas.
Thank you. We named her Freya, after the Norse goddess of love, beauty, fertility. And that was one of the things that I was worried about, was like having to tell like my, you know, my child the things that I went through, the things that I'd done. and to be able to like really explain it to her. And I feel like I have the mind now that I can explain it to her without the fear or that hatred that I, to be honest with you, that I had towards myself. And I can now see why I went through what I went through and why it was super important that I never took my life to lead up to this moment. Because one of the problems with PTSD is you feel hopeless, like there's nothing.
And do like you feel like, as a man, as a Marine, as all of these like things, that you also weren't allowed to be sad or to share these emotions with anyone?
That was a problem, because it's, especially being in the infantry, there's no females at all. It's a big masculine bunch of alpha males running around, and that's why you just don't express that, really. You talk about problems, but you still like laugh it off as if it's nothing. So amongst veterans, yeah, we would talk about the things we went through, but in a different manner. We didn't really show the pain that we were going through.
But you know that there's a lot of guys just like you who are home, who have PTSD. And right now, basically, you have a megaphone to speak to them. Is there something that you would like to say to vets just like who are going through what you're going through with PTSD?
One of the hardest things is that you don't seem to listen out there because you don't think there is any hope, but there is. And there's more strength than calling out for help. You know, you remember that when you're in the military, that's the whole point of your brother being there. I'm not afraid to cry. I mean, it's part of it. And that's one of the things is that, you know, we were taught in boot camp, you don't cry, you don't apologize, you don't say you're sorry, you don't go to emotions. And when you felt what you felt in combat, they always said that, suck it up until you get back to base. And so everybody was dealing with their stuff in private. So I feel like just being honest and telling everybody my story, it kind of inspires hope. I feel like perhaps that's my purpose in doing this, is, you know, admitting that I had a problem and stepping up and being brave enough to actually confront it, because it really is hard. There's a big level of fear that keeps you from touching that wound. But the medicine helps remove that fast. It really gets not pushed to the side, but it turns down that fear volume to where you're comfortable enough and you want to talk about it. So
I think you have inspired, hopefully, a lot of vets who are struggling with what to do, to know that there's hope. And you have a very powerful story, and I really thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Nicholas Blackston is a Marine combat veteran who did two deployments to Iraq between 2004 and 2008. He was one of the first veterans to get the experimental MDMA treatment for his severe PTSD. Nicholas, thanks so much for sharing your story and for being vulnerable and for being with us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you. Give me the time for having me on.
Who's going to care for the ones who care for the ones who went to war? There's landmines in the living room and eggshells on the floor.
As we've been hearing all hour, returning to civilian life after combat can be challenging, painful, and for some, feel impossible.
You stare out of the window as our dreams go down the drain.
Singer and songwriter Mary Gaucher tried to capture this experience in her new album, Rifles and Rosary Beads.
The war after the war.
The album was written in collaboration with combat veterans and attempts to capture the invisible wounds of war. Reporter Libby Dankman spoke with a wounded service member and Mary Gaucher about the process of putting together the album.
Rifles and rosary beads.
Joshua Gertz joined the Army after high school. He had some uncles who served, and he thought college wasn't for him. That was 1999. Fast forward a few years to Gertz driving a truck on his last night of deployment in Iraq.
My vehicle was hit with a roadside bomb, which left me with brain injury and some spinal cord damage. I typically rely on a wheelchair. I'm not wheelchair bound, but it makes things difficult.
It was the psychological wounds that nearly killed Gertz. At one point, after returning home to his wife Lisa and two sons in New York, he attempted suicide.
I felt like I was a burden, and it was almost like I wanted my family to be able to laugh again.
You hold on to what you need.
Lisa was looking for help when she came across a news article about a nonprofit that pairs veterans with professional songwriters.
Knowing my love for music, she thought it would be something that I would maybe go to.
Gertz grew up near Buffalo in a musical family, but he'd never written a song before. And that's common, says Nashville singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher. She's been volunteering as a mentor with Songwriting with Soldiers for about 5 years. The organization holds several retreats a year all over the country. Each veteran produces a song by the end of the weekend. It's free to service members and their partners. Here's Mary Gaucher.
Soldiers are trained not to be vulnerable. But when they come home, they've got to learn it. And part of telling the story is being uncomfortably vulnerable. But that's what songs do. If the songwriter can find the melody that correlates with the trauma that the veteran is trapped in, it helps to move that story into language.
Pour my baby from my breast. Now my name in rank.
This year, Gaucher released an entire album co-written with military veterans from the program. The 11 tracks on Rifles and Rosary Beads dig deep into the veteran experience, including stories you may not typically associate with military service. The song Brothers takes listeners to the emotional deployment of a new mom.
Wipe my face, change my soaking bra, told my body not to feel at all, tried to be like you. What must I do to prove that I'm a brother too?
I learned a lot writing with Megan Cunahan and Brittany Fadd, being the first generation of females in combat. And the mantra that they had to deal with is no special treatment.
Another track was co-written with half a dozen military wives and songwriter Beth Nielsen Chapman, who wrote the monster hit This Kiss for Faith Hill.
Beth and I sat with the wives, and they started to talk about what they called the war after the war.
There's landmines in the living room and eggshells on the floor. I lost myself in the shadow of your honor and your pain.
They have to serve in silence a lot of the time. And our veterans have told me over and over again, look, the hero here is my wife. I don't ever want to tie a song in a little bow. Life doesn't work that way, and war doesn't ever work that way. You know, Leonard Cohen said it best, the crack is how the light gets in. We don't connect at our strengths. We connect at our vulnerabilities.
On the first night of the retreat, Josh Gertz came in skeptical. But Gaucher's vulnerable performance convinced him she would be a reliable songwriting partner.
It was just something about her words, being able to express so many complex feelings with such a simple way of saying it, and I just felt like that would be somebody I could talk to.
So they started talking, Gaucher looking for a way to uncover his song.
She said, so, you know, looking back on it, what do you think that one thing that's kind of weighing you down is? And I said, I don't know, who the hell knows?
Looking back now, who the hell knows? Dead soldier goes.
I was just blown away that it could be that simple. And then once I started opening up and being truly honest with her, I think Mary saw where the true hurt, my true pain was coming from.
That song became Still on the Ride. Instead of dwelling on his own life-changing injuries, Gertz chose to memorialize a fallen friend. Thomas Falk died November 7th, 2000, just before their one-year anniversary in the Army.
I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone. But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
I mean, we spent pretty much every second of every day together since the day we joined the Army, and he was family.
Me and my
I shouldn't be here. Why him and not me? With all that, I should be the one. And I think from that kind of stemmed the idea that maybe he went first to be my guardian angel and make sure I made it through those things. And my
stomach's in my... Gertz says he works every day to maintain his mental health. He's played harmonica on stage with Mary Gaucher on her Rifles and Rosary Beads tour, and he credits songwriting with Soldiers with helping him open up and trust someone else with his story.
It's always going to be there. You just have better training, better tools to deal with it, and more support to deal with it. I shouldn't be
here. You shouldn't be gone. In Los Angeles, I'm Libby Denkman. But it's not up to me who
dies and who carries on. That story comes to us from the American Homefront Project. And before we leave you today, your tributes to those you're remembering on this Memorial Day.
This is Karen Wieberg. I'm calling from Wilmington, Massachusetts. On this Memorial Day, I'm remembering my dad, Sven Wieberg, who served in the Air Force during the Korean War. He went to become a pilot when he was 19, but because he was colorblind and couldn't read the signal flags, they put him in the Air Force band because he could play an instrument. I love you, Pop. I miss you every day.
Hi, this is from Uta Pete from Orlando, Florida. Memorial Day, I will be remembering my Uncle Jeffrey, 17-year-old kid from Bermuda who was shot down over English Channel. Body was never found.
Hi, my name is Maureen Christman. I'm calling from Edinburgh, Virginia. And I am remembering my father, Donald J. Post, who was from Belleville, New Jersey. He did not serve during active war, but was in Aniwetok when they were testing the nuclear bombs, and he died of a related cancer at the age of 48. He did give everything for the service of his country.
Thanks to everyone for being with us, and to the men and women who serve in uniform, we thank you for your service. Enjoy the rest of the long holiday weekend. I'm Tanzina Vega, back with more tomorrow, and this is The Takeaway. You're pushing me forward, and you'll never let go. I shouldn't be here, you shouldn't be gone. But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.